we turn to our friend, writer Colin Fleming, whose newest book, I say his newest book, he's got another one coming out very soon, and more after that. His latest, though, is Meatheads Say the Realest Things, available everywhere, and looking forward to his book on Sam Cooke coming soon as well. Hello, Colin.
What is up there, RGK?
I'm just, man, I've been enjoying reading all the updates as you you put the full court press on some of these knuckleheads in the publishing industry.
Gets a little dramatic, doesn't it, my emails? You find that? Heartbeat goes a little bit faster. Quite a lot going on, right?
Listen, you got to do what you got to do, right? Sometimes you need to take them and right by the collar and shake them.
Yeah, well, it's not the type of thing I like to do sometimes, but you saw that. Sometimes I wonder, like, when you don't comment, I think, like, oh, no, does Kimball think I've gone too far, and he's just going to lay in the weeds and keep it zipped. But, like, you saw that thing I had to send to the editor the other day.
Yes. Right?
You saw how he talked to me, and it's like, I hate having to do that kind of thing, but at what point do you just say, like, you can't defecate on me anymore? You can't. I mean, it goes on for years. It takes years before I say something like I did, and then I have to move it to the blog, and it's just not what I want to be doing. But like I've said to you before, I'm just not losing to these people. It's just not on the table for me.
So what's the status of the Sam Cooke book? When are we likely to see that?
Oh, you're going to see that in September. I don't know the exact date, but you can pre-order it on Amazon. And it, actually, you've been able to pre-order it for quite a while. I shouldn't say this. I can say this now. You could pre-order it before I even started writing it, because that's just the kind of guy I am. And so it's a little nerve-wracking to see, like, the book and the cover and all that on Amazon. It's like, ooh, I should start this. But it's really good. You can pre-order it on Amazon or anywhere else, even like Walmart. You can get it there. You can get it anywhere. It will be everywhere, and it's going to be excerpted, I learned, on today, or I learned about this today on the Daily Beast come September, and I'm sure there'll be other things happening as well. So, yes, go buy it. As John Lennon once said about his book, it's only cheap. And it's true. It's cheap. It's like $15.
Wow. A bargain at any price. Sorry, we've got many things to talk about today. Let's begin with this. A pilot for an animated series that was never picked up and yet still managed to win an Emmy in 1980 as the best animated television program of the year, Carlton, Your Doorman.
I didn't even know about the Emmy. Did it really?
Yeah.
Wow. Had you seen it before?
I had not seen it before, and I knew Lorenzo Music. I was familiar with him from Rhoda and everything else, and also a great story that one of our guests told us a while back. I think it was the TV critic Jennifer Cation Armstrong, that Lorenzo Music was very popular in the writer's room at the Mary Tyler Moore Show because he always had the best weed.
Well, watching this particular pilot, that doesn't surprise me, right? I think one thing we can say, it's certainly true, is it was quite far ahead of its time.
Yes.
The idea of an adult cartoon. But it wasn't Fritz the Cat. It wasn't that kind of adult, sort of like, okay, this is going to play at this movie theater. It was meant for mainstream primetime consumption, and it prefigures shows such as The Simpsons and Family Guy and a lot of the late night Cartoon Network lineup and South Park even. It is kind of crazy how advanced and prescient it was. And it involves Carlton, the doorman from Rhoda, who everyone knows him for his voice. And that's the only way you knew him, on Rhoda. And then, of course, he was the voice of Garfield. I think that's probably how a lot of people know him now, of a certain age. You can sort of like figure out what generation you're in based on, you know him from Rhoda, you know him as Garfield. And so he plays in this anime version. He voices the doorman. And he's like this pot-smoking, perpetually humping, lazy slacker guy. And you see his world of Carlton. So you certainly see him. He's not just the voice. And he has this eccentric mom who rifles through the garbage, and there's verbal humor. Like, she finds him, she's well, it's supposed to be a pair of galoshes, but it's only one. And they make this joke about, oh, you got me a galosh. It becomes sort of like this running beat throughout the episode. And you can tell. I mean, obviously, I'm going to like it because there's a cat death. And it's not a murder, so you're free to celebrate that. You are. When it's the natural death of an animal and you don't like the animal, you can be like, huzzah, you can. So he's out running in the park with the cat. He's cat watching, and the cat has his heart attack. It made me crack up, Kimball. I really did. And then I had some hibiscus tea for my own blood pressure. I took it as a cautionary tale.
And Carlton doesn't look like you might have imagined him to look on the Rota show.
No, he doesn't. And that was one of my first thoughts, was how are they going to make this guy look like you think he'd be? He should look. Not maybe like in a way that he should look based upon what you've imagined, but should look in a way that it works. And it does work. He's like this sort of hairy guy, and he's like 70s, kind of born, but with the whole, like, but it's blonde. So, I don't know, it kind of, like, melts into him a little bit. It's not like, is like, Ron Jeremy-esque, necessarily, although he's like, he shows up at work, and he's like, back when you could joke about things, and he just starts drinking his ass off in the morning, like in this little cubby hole. And he has this Mrs. Roper woman type who tries to seduce him. And it was whimsical, it's cutting edge. And I don't like when you say this thing, like, well, what were they thinking, that they could ever get this bought and become a series? Because I think people would have watched it. I would have watched it. It's funny.
It was great. It was a little bit too ahead of its time.
It was, but I always, like, to me, that's on, I think we have to be careful with that phrase, because to me it's usually on the backs of the decision makers.
Right.
Like, it's not actually too far ahead of its time, I don't think. I mean, we don't know. But if it had come out, I don't think it would have been like, well, it only aired, and then, like, I think it would have done pretty well. I really do. Because, look, we could have discussed the pilot of All in the Family, and if that wasn't bought, and we could have the same conversation about being too far ahead of its time, but it obviously wasn't, right? You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Almost like that's going to be something that we determine based upon, like, ratings, but it's not actually inherent to the thing itself. I think, just again, these powers that be can do a huge disservice for not just the public, but also their own bottom line. Because I think this would have done well. And it really, at the time, it wouldn't have had competition in its field.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. By the way, our friend Joe Mason says he's pre-ordered your book, and it says there that it's available officially September 9th.
September 9th, okay. So Mr. Mason is he's on the ball.
Yeah,
that makes sense, September 9th. I knew it was like the 9th or the 12th, But Kimball, when you're a man with so many books, it's hard to... No. Well, it
my book, whenever that comes out, I will know, because that'll be it.
Oh, the one that you lowballed me on the offer to ghostwrite. I'm getting lowballed a lot today, so I'm not taking kindly. I'm actually being lowballed by some Mainers, so that's not... Well, you know about that too, but I won't say anything yet. I will reserve judgment and do the trashing when I'm absolutely positive.
All right. That sounds like a good plan. In the meantime, let's talk about one of the great radio series of all time and a couple of terrific episodes of suspense. One of them, which is often referred to as possibly the scariest radio show of all time, House on Cypress Lane, Cypress Canyon.
It is, yeah, you do see it. It crops up on those lists, and it sounded from your reaction social media the other day that you might not have experienced the show before.
No, I had, because I think you mentioned it to me maybe a year or so ago, and I checked it out, and it was as good as advertised.
So this is, we're doing kind of Christmas in July here, because this is theoretically a Christmas episode, and it's a frame story. And it's a frame story that works really well. Now, suspense could be ropey, because it could be over the top. And sometimes when things are going along pretty convincingly, there was this twist ending for the sake of a twist ending at the end. It's like, oh, come on, that's not very believable. So there weren't a lot of suspense episodes, even though it ran for a long time, where they work all the way through. everything is integrated and it's not over the top, it's not excessive, and this is certainly one of the best. And it's this guy who's like visiting his buddy who sells real estate about this new property that's listed. It's just been built. And when the guy says, I was there and I found, like, even though they're still putting it together, this is out in California, I found like this manuscript. And I have to tell you, it's kind of creeping me out a bit. And the other guys was like, no, come on. It's just something that some screenwriter left behind. It's not, oh, it's a pretty good yarn, whatever. And then they go into what this manuscript is. So it's like a found text. And you'll get that in M.R. James. It's kind of a classic technique. Given a different spin here, in this frame story that suggests the 1945 film Dead of Night, which is an omnibus piece where Mervyn John shows up. He's an architect. So again, we have this architect idea. He shows up to do some renovations at the country estate, and he ends up seeing these guests, and he knows these guests from his dream. And they all also share these like sort of ghostly stories. And then the frame story comes full circle at the very end, the coda sort of to the film. So that's what's going to happen here. And the stuff that we find out that went on in this house is some really bad, creepy. I mean, this is a legit, when we say something scary, it's usually not scary, right? This is actually scary. Like, if you listen to this when you were in bed at night, you would have a hard time falling asleep.
Yeah, and because you don't see the twist. This time, the twist works.
In fact, when you say that, I'm not even sure I know what the twist per se is that you're referencing. Because you go into this world, this life of this husband and wife, and they're dealing with, it's, it sounds like a cat, but it's not really going to be a cat the way we think of a cat. And I think the disembodied sound effect, the actual voice, it's almost like with Carlton, you have to get the look right, and here you have to get the sound right. This is why I was thinking of it last night. It's similar to the thing on the Forble board from the episode of Quiet Please, where you have to have the sound of the creature work, or else the thing is going to fall to pieces. It's like, you've ever seen that film Curse of the Demon, which is based upon the M.R. James story, Casting the Ruin. The director, Jacques Tenor, didn't want to have the monster in the film because he thought, well, if the monster doesn't work, the entire film falls apart if you don't buy into that monster. It's a great-looking monster, actually. But sometimes that's why the monster doesn't get shown in cinema, and it can work really well. But I feel like in a way we're shown the monster here via the sound, and then we think we've wrapped up and we're back in the real estate office, and something happens that we don't want to happen. And as it's happening, we're like, oh, no, don't do this. It's like, oh, this is upsetting. And it's good.
And another episode of Suspense, and you pointed this out, I think, on the blog the other day. A lot of people point to Lucille Fletcher's Sorry Wrong Number as one of the great radio plays of all time. And it's up there, but it's not even her best because The Hitchhiker is so much better.
Orson Welles, who stars in this episode, he said that Sorry Wrong Number was the greatest radio play ever written. And I don't really understand that. Although I've come around a bit on what Welles said about Hitchcock and some of his films just not being very good at all. I've started to think that Hitchcock is quite overrated, but I feel the same way about Sorry Wrong Number, but I don't feel that way about The Hitchhiker. And again, it's one of the perfect suspense episodes. It is quite actually terrifying. And Welles is so good. Welles sets it up right away, and he has a comfort on the radio, a confidence on the radio that not many people have ever had on the radio. He's completely within his medium, his métier, and he starts saying that he has this reputation for spook stories. But that's strange because he doesn't really do any. He makes a sort of in-joke about famous War of the Worlds broadcast from Halloween Eve in 1938. And he plays this part brilliantly. He's going to be leaving his home in, what is it, New Jersey. He says goodbye to his mom, gets in the car, and he's looking forward to this adventure, to drive to his new life, his new job on the other side of the country. And he encounters this man as he's going over the Brooklyn Bridge, thumbing a ride. And the descriptions of the man are so great, because even when it's not raining, although he first sees him, crucially, when it's raining, the guy always has these splashes of water on his shoulder, which is just this creepy detail that, again, stacks and stacks. You want to have details stacked. So eventually, the listener, the reader, the viewer, whatever, adds them up and goes, oh, that's that. That's pretty upsetting. And so that's what happens here.
I didn't realize it until I was doing a little bit of research that Lucille Fletcher's husband at the time was the wonderful composer Bernard Herrmann, who wrote the music for this and, of course, several Hitchcock films and a number of Twilight Zone episodes. Great stuff, and it works so well in this.
That's why Wells was involved. It was because of the Bernard Herrmann connection. So they worked, and people think, like, well, they worked on Citizen Kane. But they worked on many more things besides Citizen Kane, going back to the Mercury Theater. Like a lot of those people, Bernard Herrmann being one of them, got their start out of that radio laboratory, really. That's what the Mercury Theater was. It was more than just a collective. It was more than just a team put out these radio plays. It was a hotbed and hothouse of experimentation within that medium. And so Wells, I think it's one of his best thespian performances, and there isn't a bum note in the entire episode. I can't think of anything where you'd think, okay, they should tweak that. He did it a few times, but it just, he nails it here. The suspense is the second time he's done it. And it's just, again, it's note perfect. It's terrifying. You don't know exactly what's going to happen. He picks up a hitchhiker to go along with him, ends up creeping her out. It's there's just nothing that you can even edit, tweak. Perfect horror radio.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. A couple of weeks back, we talked about Laurel and Hardy's Sons of the Desert. This time around, a film that's not as widely known by people from 1930, Blotto.
It's a short, and I'd say it's one of their more appreciated shorts. And you have to set up, it's pretty common in these films of these two, where you have just the termagant of a wife, and that's Laurel's wife. I guess we can assume that Hardy is single. Hardy is calling up his buddy, his boy, Laurel, to get him to come out for night on the town, and he has to deal with the old ball and chain. And it's the Prohibition era. So what they want to do is get lit up like a Christmas tree and drink that booze and go out to a club and not have the women folk around, very bonanza-like that way. And I love when Laurel, she goes in, his wife goes into like another room to listen on the extension, and he says something like, she's so dumb, she'll never be able to figure it out. he's very confident, Dan Laurel is, more so than usual in this particular short. And so she doctors the liquor. She has a bottle of liquor from like some present. It's almost like a hand-me-down. It's supposed to be special and saved for this revered occasion. She puts in like the Tabasco sauce, which I was heartened to know that the label looks the exact same way it looks on the Tabasco sauce now, so that hasn't changed. And they steal the liquor, and she encourages them to go out because it's not going to work out well, and they go to the club, and they're just drinking this absolute putridity. And they're pretending, or they've tricked themselves into thinking, that they're hammered. And so there's just these subtle gestures that they make where the comedy comes from. But Laurel's like making a fool out of himself, and Hardy just reaches down and he moves his glass away from him. Like, you wouldn't even notice it necessarily, but only like 3 inches. That's going to all of a sudden make them these masters of sobriety. And so eventually the wife shows up, and it's just one of the funniest lines when Laurel can't stop laughing because he wants to have this big, like, sort of piss take of a moment. And finally he just howls at her, "We drank your liquor."
I love it. But that's a hard one to find unless you're looking for, there's a foreign language version of it, right?
Oh, there were foreign language versions of just about everything at the time. So, yeah, a lot of those, Laurel and Hardy. I should say, like, in the early sound era. That's why we have the Spanish Dracula, because the thinking was that people, they don't want these subtitles. You have to go and have these other versions for, like, the Mexican market, like, quite literally the Mexican market. And so there are a lot of that with Laurel and Hardy's, and Trainspotters can track down, all that kind of things. And there are different cuts of their films and whatnot. But it's what, like less than a half hour. It passes very quickly. And I think sometimes we can think of Laurel and Hardy, you fall into like the Three Stooges trap. I don't like the Three Stooges. To me, it's just dumb. It's imbecilic. I don't like any of it. It's not smart. And I think people think Laurel and Hardy fat thin, and they're just going to kind of be like these dopey clowns. They're not. And just because I say they're sophisticated doesn't mean it's going to go over your head, because it won't. They're just really spot on with the humor. And it has a high level of rewatchability. You'll notice things that you didn't notice before. And they just make everything funny with so little effort. Like when Hardy's in the phone booth and he keeps forgetting the number and he has to keep saying it to the operator. Finally, he just rips the page out and like uses some saliva to fasten to the wall. It ends up becoming this gag because you don't expect to see it. And what it means is he's going to keep forgetting and have to keep calling back. He's taken a very simple task and turned it into this huge, like, gargantuan adventure.
Finally, we want to talk a little bit of baseball from a recent a piece you did for the Smart Set about Babe Ruth and a couple of seasons that may be among the greatest, if not the greatest, in baseball history. And it's not the one people would think of first.
No, the one people will think of first is, for Ruth, is 1927. And that's the year that he hits the 60 home runs. And he's there with the Murderers Row Yankees and Lou Gehrig and all that jazz. And so Ruth, though, when he became this full-time hitter, when he first got to the Yankees, so in 1920, 1921, he put up numbers that, the whole thing about, oh, this is the best season anyone's ever had, and they're having it right now because they do some pitching, too. That's silly. That shows me that, because a lot of this really isn't up for debate. And it doesn't mean it's like, just look at the war. If you look at someone's stat line for a given year, all of the stats, the basic stats that have always been there, batting average, RBI, home run, runs scored, and you look at the modern metrics, war and OPS plus, all that kind of stuff, You should be able to read that and understand the significance of that season. So Ruth is going to have like a huge amount of walks that year. I don't have it in front of me, but I know he had 457 total bases, which is the all-time record, more than Roger Hornsby, who I think is second. So that's the thing, though. Like when Jim Rice had his 400 total base season in 1978, do you know why he achieved that? Because he didn't walk. So, like, Jim Rice didn't even have an OPS of 1,000. I'm pretty sure he's the only person to have 400 total bases and an OPS under 1,000. So to get to 457 and walk 150 times, it means you're doing something significant, or getting on base at least, almost like every time you get up, it feels like.
Yeah, he had an on-base percentage. Well, in 20, it was 532. And in 21, it was 512. His OPS over 1.3 both of those years. That's ridiculous.
And what was his batting average in 21?
376 in 1920, and then 378 in 1921. And by the way, for all those home runs, 54 and then 59, he struck out just 80 times.
It's funny because, like, at the time, it was like, well, that's the price you pay for all those home runs, is you have those 89 strikeouts.
He never struck out 100 times in a season.
Now that's less than half,
right,
of a season for some people. And I think really kind of the thrust of the piece was that not just these numbers, but he was playing the game the way hitters would like to approach offense now.
Right, before we knew what launch angle was, he was doing it.
Yeah, but he was doing it with a level of virtuosity that people don't do now. But he was a three absolute outcome guy. Walk, home run. I mean, he did other things. Obviously, like the doubles, not like it was like low, and he got a bunch of triples and all that stuff. He even was in the top 10 in stolen bases a couple of years. But he was playing the way, and I think this is what's notable, because he was supposed to be this lunkhead, this idiot. But think about this. He played the game. He took an approach that absolutely no one took at the time. And it wasn't like, oh, I'm stronger than everyone. He wasn't Paul Bunyan. He wasn't. He decided to take a mental approach to the game that no one else was taking. It would take a long time for people to catch up with him, and then their physical skills couldn't deliver the same way. But for a guy supposed to be a moron, imagine like what goes into that. It's really progressive thinking, saying, I'm going to go about my at-bats this way. I'm going to have an uppercut swing. I am going to put an emphasis on walks, on getting on base. True, his batting average was through the roof, but he was playing a different kind of game than people were playing, and he never gets any credit for that. You just think he's this sort of pot-bellied guy, broad-shouldered, who swung really hard with a big bat.
And you mentioned the stolen bases. He had 14 in 1920, 17 in 1921. But what I love about the Ruth stolen base stats is that he was terrible at it, but he kept trying. In 1923, he stole 17 bases, but he got thrown out 21 times.
That's the thing, though. Back then, I mean, not just back then, but for a while, guys were terrible at stealing bases. So, like, if you wanted to lead the league in stolen bases, you would also kind of suck at stealing bases. It's weird. Like, you'll see, like, Lou Brock caught 23 times. Like, the percentages, Maury Wills, Louis Aparicio, those guys, they always got thrown out a lot. And, like, even if, like, I would imagine, just off the top of my head, it would have to be that Ricky Henderson has been thrown out stealing more than anyone ever. I mean, his percentage was getting higher as you got into like the 80s and the early 90s, that kind of thing. But that was sort of like the live by the sword, die by the sword credo of the stolen base merchant. So,
well, right, sure, and he was the goat, the old fashioned goat, the bad kind of goat. I think it was 1926 when the World Series ended against St. Louis when he got thrown out stealing.
Yeah, that was not a smart move because there was no need for him. That would have been just like the bonehead Twitter trending type of thing. That's just like one of those like worst ever plays in baseball. And like it's kind of strange to say you think he would have won more than he did because he won with the Red Sox, World Series with the Red Sox. But that Yankees team would sometimes find ways to lose in the 1920s that it's just surprising. I mean, they don't win in 21, right? So he's having this all-time great year, but they're faltering. Of course, they win in 27 and they win in 28. And then things shift to being more of Gehrig's team come like the early 1930s. But a player who really just came up with a new way, almost like he was some modernist folk hero of sport during that same modernist era of James Joyce and whatnot. But no one has ever talked about him that way. And it just bothers me so much. I saw this on Twitter. It's like, oh, it's the best season ever. And a few people mentioned Ruth and they say 1927. It's like, it's just so lazy. Just go to Baseball Reference and learn how to read what numbers mean. They will tell you, not every statistic tells a story, but in combination, they do. You can read it. It's the same as like reading like this flashcard of truth if you're able to parse those numbers.
Well, check out Colin's piece in SmartSet, smartset.com. By the way, Ricky Henderson, all-time caught stealing leader in Major League Baseball history with 335. And in that year when he set the all-time record with 130 steals, he got caught a Major League record 42 times.
And you figure that he would have had to, right? Because every time he got on base, you must have known, huge advantage for the catcher and the pitcher, the dude's going. Like, if you're going to steal 130 bases, there's no like mystery what happens after you walk.
Right.
Like, what are the chances that you don't go? Like 15%? You're going practically every time. And so, yeah, that's not it's like one of those statistics you want to be high up on. It's like you want to be one of the all-time leaders in like strikeouts and hitting into double plays. If you're one of the all-time baseball leaders in hitting into double plays, you're probably a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. By the way, the National League leader all-time, Lou Brock. Pretty good base stealer as well.
Another guy who got over 100 before, right? Henderson did. So live by the sword, die by the sword.
There you go. Colin Fleming. Check out his newest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things. Do what I just did while we were talking. Yeah, I multitasked, and I pre-ordered my copy of Sam Cooke Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, available sometime in September. Lock that in. Visit the website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Thank you, Colin.
All right. See you, buddy.
You got it. Catch you next week.